All right, the next case that we've got is Permulic Corporation versus Pacheco, In re Pacheco. It's a 2019 opinion at 788 Fed Appendix 288. It's on page 3 of the materials. This case highlights the dangers of counsel withdrawals and the importance of timely filing an appellate brief. Here, following the debtor's filing for Chapter 7 relief, a lender filed a complaint to object to the dischargeability of roughly $800,000 in debt owed by the debtors to the lender. Late in the game, the lender obtained new counsel and filed a motion to amend its complaint after the discovery deadline had already passed. The parties jointly also moved for an additional modification to the scheduling order. While the court granted the motion to modify the scheduling order, the court denied the motion to amend the complaint. Then, on the due date of the joint pretrial order, the lender's second lawyer filed a motion to withdraw. And ultimately, while the court granted the motion, the court imposed requirements on the lender to locate new counsel who makes an appearance in the case, files a proposed pretrial order, and files proposed findings and conclusions by a date certain, the failure of which would result in dismissal of the case. After the lender failed to comply with the deadline, the adversary was dismissed for want of prosecution, not surprisingly. At that point, the lender retained new counsel who unsuccessfully moved to reopen the case. Thereafter, a timely appeal was filed by the lender, but the lender failed to timely file its appellate brief. It's like the worst of all situations. Thus, on motion by the debtor, appellees, the district court dismissed the appeal. On further appeal to the Fifth Circuit noted that the dismissal of an appeal for failure to comply with the rules is reviewable on an abuse of discretion standard, and finding that the court had not abused its discretion, the dismissal was affirmed. Again, just notes the significance implications of changing counsel by clients at the last second, and also kind of a note for counsel who are stepping in to be wary of what you might be stepping into. All right, Eddie.
Thanks, Lee. Going to page 4 of your materials, we have the Willis case, Fifth Circuit. This is one of a series, a couple of cases that talk about arbitration, which is a very timely topic in the Fifth Circuit. And I'm going to be speaking on both of those. So this is the first one we're going to talk about today. And this came out of Mississippi. And essentially, I've got to give you a little bit of context of how this came up to the Fifth Circuit. In the lower court, the debtors, before they filed bankruptcy, took out a couple of loans with Mississippi, loan of Mississippi Tower. And they took out two loans and they signed two arbitration agreements. And the two arbitration agreements, one of them was signed by the debtor plaintiff and the other one was not, but they were both reviewed debtor signed both of them, but one was signed by the defendant Tower Loan and the other one was not, but they were both presented to the debtor for signature. And so the debtor files bankruptcy and then files a complaint against the loan company saying that they violated the TILA, among other statutes. And so the defendant comes in and says, well, you know, we're going to file a motion. We filed a motion to request arbitration. And so when it came to the bankruptcy court, the bankruptcy court reviewed the two arbitration agreements. And they said, well, you know, the two arbitration agreements are very similar to each other. For example, they both require arbitration for all disputes arising between the two parties and the insurance company, and also any disputes regarding the loan or the policies. Both delegated to the arbitrator the power to decide gateway arbitrability issues, and also including whether which claim is covered by the arbitration agreements. But here's the rub: the arbitration agreements conflicted over several provisions. We're going to go over those in a little more detail in just a minute. The bankruptcy court denied the motion to arbitrate and held that the conflicting provisions and the two agreements meant that there was not a meeting of the minds between the parties, and therefore declined to order the parties to arbitrate. The district court affirmed, So then Tower Loan appeals. And in the appeal, the Fifth Circuit, and this is where I want to draw your attention, says, look, we have a two-part test we're going to look at when we get a motion to compel arbitration. First, we apply state law, determine whether or not the parties formed any arbitration agreement at all. And second, we're going to interpret the contract, determine whether any claim, this particular claim being raised by the plaintiffs in this case, is covered by the arbitration agreement. However, Fifth Circuit said, look, ordinarily the second step would be something that either a bankruptcy court or we would look at, which is whether or not the claim is covered. But in this case, there is a delegation clause. The delegation clause is where the agreement states that the arbitrator has a primary power to rule on the arbitrability of any claim, specific claim in this case. And therefore, the arbitrator gets to decide whether or not this claim is arbitrable. So that's the test that the Fifth Circuit has. And that's something you might want to have ingrained in some of your materials there, because that's what you need to really be careful about when you're looking at these agreements and making these arguments to the bankruptcy court. So the Fifth Circuit went through the process and they said, first of all, we do have separate, we're looking at the contract, whether or not the parties actually had a meeting of the minds. And even though there were separate documents, and they had different requirements, they were signed simultaneously. The parties, the Fifth Circuit real easily just found that they did have a binding contract. And they did have a meeting of the minds because they both signed the documents.